Explain to me more of the process of becoming an actual member of the Commons, past the point of being an extended member through Traveler. What kind of projects or what kind of selection, what kind of criteria is needed to become a full-fledged member of the Commons? Is it a business type of situation?
Yeah, Jeremy, that's a very good question. Generally, and we're kind of groping forward here. We have very little of this written down, just the general framework, because we're trying to establish the culture before we write it down through an oral process. So the way I explain it is, if, for instance, and there's several ways to do things. If an existing member says, you know what, there's this great project, and we need your skills, and in fact, you probably would fit pretty well in the group, so I'm going to nominate you to be a member. And you know, there are certain rules. You're like a provisional member. You would complete the project, and everybody would say, you know, it was just great working with Jeremy, and he's a cool guy, and he's not political, and he's not going to, you know, because frankly, many companies' problems start when HR hires in a whole batch of people nobody's ever screened or ever looked at. And then there's all these personality problems, and one bad apple spoils the whole batch. And so you have to go through this testing screening period, and it's usually unpaid, to establish you really want to do this. And then the group nominates you for the permanent membership, and then you're in. It doesn't mean you get a salary or you're a subcontractor. It means that you now have the ability to explore possibilities, and you may end up, of course, being on a paid subcontract later on. The other ways is if you bring a project into the Commons and say, there's this, I can bring my skills and a project into the Commons, or I'll do your website, or I'll do some task, or I'll, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's pretty much, it's a Benedictine organization. It's focused on work and projects. So it all comes down to getting projects done. I hope that answers the question.
It does a little bit. I was wondering as to the nature of the projects that you're be considered to be part of a digital space type project, in addition to what I was saying.
Well, it's pretty broad. It's all software right now. I mean, we're not building aircraft or anything, so it could be, you know, it's mostly oriented toward our skill set, which is 3D, to some extent communications mechanisms, like our Blobber project, which you may be hearing about more soon, and that's a lightweight blob that floats on your web page, which is not 3D at all, but it's about communications. Or the NASA simulation projects, could even be an art project. Rotava's line was more on that scope. It could be, working on the code base for Traveler or building some widget. So that's really, there's a variety of things. If you look at the showcase, it's kind of a little bit representative. But anything that sort of fits where the overall Commons wants to go and the skill sets it wants to develop. Like, there's a whole new need now for PHP MySQL programming because we have a project going in that, and that's not really 3D at all. Any more questions? Hello, guys.
Hey, Todd. You covered so much, it's hard to come up with questions.
I know, we had that pregnant pause Steve DePaul talked about yesterday. The that which is unspoken is communicating a lot, I guess.
Are you guys on the train going back? I'm sorry. Are you guys enjoying coming back and seeing what people are doing with the program? Because I think you've got another generation of travelers that are self-creating themselves in the community. And
How do you guys feel about it?
Well, the Brillo, that was you, right?
Yeah.
It's wonderful, and I have to confess that I haven't spent as much time in Traveler as I should. I'm pulled so many ways that it's very difficult. And in fact, currently we have three members that are regular Traveler users. Steve Turner, who you know, Australian Steve, Course Oz, and Harold, who ran Virtual Party, and I hope I'm not missing anybody. Harold's kind of, Harold initially was going to sort of work on the Traveler code base with Noel Paul Stuckey, but it didn't materialize in time to do Virtual Party. So we're still trying to figure out what Harold would really do. But Oz and Steve have been very involved, and they're kind of our channel into the Traveler world. But Brillo, I was very impressed by seeing the spaces you made and hearing about the world assembler that you're putting together, because that's the kind of evolution we can do, and it's very thrilling. And if there's anything that the digital space group can do, including involving the people who are working very hard in this community as members, please don't hesitate to shoot me an email about it.
Cool.
Howard, I think you had a question. I think Howard was mentioning Open Croquet. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a number of every generation seems to have, there's like Open Croquet and several other new virtual world, social, creative virtual world platforms. And I think it is tantamount on all of us to go out and experiment with those and maybe try to help guide the teams that are doing them. Because, for instance, I know the people in the Croquet project. I've met with most of them. They're at Hewlett-Packard. And I do find that they have very little reference to prior work, and that it's a I have suggested to them that it's a build it and they will come kind of a platform. It's a very large platform, and they've focused on the general vision rather than satisfying a specific narrow domain. Of course, you heard Steve DePaul yesterday so eloquently talk about how he wouldn't even work for OnLive until they narrowed their focus down to something which was the heads, the social communication, the cocktail party effect, something that was achievable and could attract a dedicated user base, which is where we are now. So Open Croquet and things like that, I hope that they go somewhere, but I fear that a lot of them lack any reference to prior work that shows successes and failures, and that the people who build these platforms generally will do the same mistakes over and over again. All right, I hope that fairly represented your question. And other questions?
Would you be surprised if this program stays alive for another 20 years? I mean, when we're old and gray and we go cruising about the internet, would you be surprised to see a tribe or community still alive?
You know, it would be incredible if this application was still running. You know, the good people at Microsoft didn't make something incompatible that didn't allow us to run the client or the server. The servers are not working as well as we'd like on the newer OSs, so that's starting to become worrisome. But I would not be surprised if in 5 years Traveler's still here as it is. I would really not be surprised, because having done the DigiBarn project, one thing I've learned is that we have come through a Cambrian explosion of complexity and stuff, but that's over. That very rapid evolution is finished. All those different businesses and different approaches. We're now in the period of extended monopolies, and the evolution has slowed dramatically. Of course, we're getting nicer devices. The processors are a little faster here and there, but there isn't the same amount of pace. Windows is going to be here in 10 years, and in 20 years, and in 30 years. It's a substrate now. It's there permanently. Just like when AT&T secured the monopoly in the early 30s, you were talking through the same switches, basically upgraded until the 80s, until they broke the AT&T monopoly. But that substrate lasted for generations, and I think that's what's going to happen. So we're going to all have blue screen of death until we go to the stars. I wouldn't be surprised if this community goes on. I'd dearly love to see the client and the server upgraded on an upgrade path with a community source type, maybe prior to an open source community source type arrangement. And we all have to make that case to Dave Collins, I think.
Can you see any future model of Traveler being of use to some of the NASA educational projects?
No, Brian, that's a good question. Truthfully, as strange as it may sound, we've banged our heads against this one as much as anybody. The use of environments like this inside of corporate settings or government settings, I think it's going to be extremely limited or almost impossible for a lot of reasons. There's a cultural problem with it. It looks like a game. Engineers are barely accepting the idea of shared collaborative computer-aided design and visualization and saying, well, it's not just a movie. It could actually represent the vehicles we build. There's a lot of skepticism. And certainly in an ordinary business setting, they'd be using Skype and Groove.net and WebEx, but that's about it. I mean, that's about what the culture can take. And there's also issues with firewalls and stuff like that because you need the channels. All that's solvable, but I think that we've just tried. I've presented Traveler at 400 events, some of them purely straight business suit events, and they look at it and they think it's cool, but there's just no cultural, there's no... one or two companies said, well, we maybe could use this. And Howard Smith can actually tell you. If Howard, are you here? You can give a little bit of a better insight into this.
Yes. We at Computer Sciences Corporation became interested in 3D worlds. In the early 90s, and sort of active worlds era, and I made a number of presentations internally to create a collaboration platform for CSC, but there was deep skepticism.
Yeah, so
CSC is now 120,000 people, and I still believe that collaboration could be significantly strengthened by creating communities of this type, as opposed to relying upon essentially shared document sets, which is what we do on our portal.
I think in a way, the corporate world, the educational world, I think looking at education and students, there's Bonnie DeVarco, who developed the BorderLink project and the virtual UC Santa Cruz project which allowed young people to go into a 3D space and tour models of campuses and actually talk to admissions officers for university. And I can see that that one might have some uptake, and that perhaps for team-based learning in elementary, K through 12, or even college, you're going to see acceptance of these environments, but very, very little in business. You know, until the metaverse is here and we're all living in there, I don't think you're going to, you're barely seeing the adoption of reasonable quality document sharing tools in the corporate and government setting these days, and they tend to all be rebuilt over and over again, the same kind of metaphors, generation after generation, just trying to get something that's effective.
If it were your decision, would you use a model like this for education and perhaps with plugins, you know, document sharing, whiteboarding, collaborative tools?
You know, what's interesting is digital space itself. You know, we used ActiveWorlds a lot to meet. We then developed, it's funny because the shared space aspect of here really gives you an idea of presence. I mean, I'm feeling as I'm here, and I feel like I'm doing a session, and we're really interacting. And so for a kind of a company meeting where everybody, you know, I could see getting, and I don't know why we haven't done this, we used to do this in ActiveWorlds, getting the whole company into Traveler and having a great talk. And I think we will do that. But for day-to-day, work, we kind of ended up sort of going back to the original model of instant messaging and email and the occasional voice meeting with Talkspace, which came out of the Traveler acquisition. And we would use that. It was sort of like a conference calling. But it ended up that everything, a lot of the projects are offline. They don't require face-to-face meetings. They require emails flooding back and forth. They don't require an immersive presence at all. In fact, I've only met Dave Rasmussen from the lab in Australia in person, and the other five people I haven't met. And we're going to go to Australia in February and meet them. And it just has worked best that way. And we're a virtual company, and perhaps we ought to be meeting in Traveler to create a team, feeling a team cohesion. I'm kind of being convinced of that just by being here today. But we actually don't use anymore shared meeting. And Stuart Gold often says it's a shame because in the days when we were building ActiveWorlds projects, there was a feeling, a sense of being there, and it was very innovative. But we don't do that anymore because the platforms don't support in-world building. So you have to go off and run your 3D modeling tool anyway to do anything and make a change. So it's a long answer to a short question, but even within our own company, we're struggling to find where this fits. And I'm starting to believe that all company meetings, like we're trying to, you know, boost our culture and solve some issues and just kind of have a pep rally would be best done in Traveler. And in fact, we haven't done a pep rally type thing, and we ought to, just to stir the pot.
Thank you.
These are all great questions, and I really appreciate them, by the way, because it makes me think about how can we do things better and use the things that are right under the tips of our noses. Another question?
Yeah, I have a question again regarding your Elixir justice system you showed earlier on in the speech. It was great to see that kind of documentation of this really old equipment, relatively old. And I was wondering, in terms of increased obsolescence, and this was brought up earlier, I think, by Grillo, but with increased obsolescence of technology, are we 18 months and stuff, if a traveler were to see light or a system like Traveler in, say, 20 years, so what steps would be placed to account for this technological obsolescence? Would it be through an emulation process, or is such stuff underway to preserve a system like Traveler?
You know, Jeremy, it's a good question. Truthfully, I think that, well, there's a couple of things here. I think that possibly we're looking at the Windows API. We may go out of compliance. I mean, Traveler itself may go out of compliance at some point. But the fact that it was built under Windows 95 and that it has survived several generations of Windows and it's running just fine leads me to believe that it actually may survive for a long time because the layer underneath is very solidified. And other truthfully, it may be that building an emulator for all of Windows may be a real challenge, especially for all the devices and stuff, but that it probably will happen. And that in fact, the Windows OS emulates DOS in its command window. And there are people who've built emulators for the entire Commodore 64 that fit on one chip in a joystick and that have 300 games in them or 30 games. And so, you know, back in 1985, that would have been considered impossible, but I met the person who did this. The whole Commodore 64 plus the games in a single chip, if you can believe it, for like $39. So I think, yes, and if we had lost, if communities had taken down the entire thing and then we had lost the servers and the source code and whatever, it would be in a much worse condition. We'd be like the palace where they can run stuff by hacking things, but there's really no central support. Oh, and Oz is texting variablemedia.net. But I think by hook or by crook, we'll keep this thing going for a long period of time.
Thank you.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
How large is the source code?
How large is the source code? I don't really know. It's not that big. Gosh, I don't know. Good question for Dave Collins. It's handleable. I think that the server's a little bit spaghetti-like. Dave Collins knows the client code. This is the only DirectX 1.0 application still running. You know, you're at Direct3D whatever 9. This is Direct3D 1. And the renderer that you are in is the RenderMorphix renderer that Microsoft bought a company called RenderMorphix, which is, of course, a British company like all good rendering companies. RenderWare is the other one, which actually is the platform ActiveWorlds uses that. And many games use that, but this is the RenderMorphix software layer here. And anyway, but it's 1995. It was just when Microsoft was looking at actually building a generic layer to support 3D. And so you're living history.
He's talking.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things I think is unique about Traveler is that even though we have a limited number of colors and polygons that we can use, I've used ActiveWorlds. I even got to do some work with Dave R. In ActiveWorlds, doing a little bit of modeling for him. You still come back to here and get that human effect. And with interactivity, like you spoke about VRML2 yesterday, I think from a builder's point of view, VRML2 would be extremely exciting to work with. Because you open up so many possibilities, so much interactivity. I think this question's been proposed before. If we change the platform, would we also take the humanity out of the program?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And to my mind, what you would strive to do is to say, look, we're going to do something really simple. We're going to support VRML2 in the scene graph. And then we're going to support D3D, OpenGL, to get to the hardware. But we're not at this point. We may swap out, as a separate step, we may swap out and support the Speaks open source server for voice. But, you know, what you would want to do is one of the criteria is that every single space that has been made in Traveler 1, you know, or Traveler 2.03, as we're calling it, works in the new Traveler as it is. It's 100% compatible, 100% of that. And then when you go through that portal and you go into a new rendered space, the morphing of the faces. Now, there may be some issues with the morphing of polygons that you can do here in this somewhat non-standard version of Vermal 1, which was done specially. And Steve and Dave can answer that more. But hopefully, every single effect that you see here, the basic face morphing for those five more points, will work in the new Vermal 2 version as well. But that you can go through that portal and come back, and it will work exactly the same. And I think that would be a decision the community would say, look, you know, if it's too high a price to pay to make that work and everybody should convert their spaces and whatever, then fine. If we do an on-the-fly conversion of any existing DSB space that just gets converted on the fly as you load it so that the old spaces run, then that's important to us. History shows that if you can do that, you generally have continuity and you lose less people and you lose less content if you can do this on-the-fly 100% compatibility emulation, if you will. And then you add, bolt on the new features. So anyway, that would be my approach from a historian of computers.
Sure. I think compatibility is well, I think Vermal 1 and 2 are very compatible. And I think they're being minimal. Even if you had to convert some spaces, I think from a code point of view, it wouldn't be too much of a change.
It is about compatibility that I would like to speak. The universities that I support and support me have a deep desire to want to port this to Linux and to Mac. And if that were so, Traveler would be much more prevalent in their curriculum. It would be much more useful to them. Now, if we have a new working model of Traveler, I think we should put some emphasis on making this cross-platform compatible. And I'm wondering, you know, I appreciate that I'm a member of the Commons, and it's probably the proudest moment of my life when I became that, and I have a vote, but that's just one vote. And I was wondering how much weight we as the Commons are willing to throw behind making this cross-platform compatible, you know, when we have a new working model for the future Traveler. You know, if that is as important as some of these other projects we got going, you know.
Well, I think to address that, in a sense, the way the Commons works is if enough members get together and say, we have resources and we're willing to do this project, the Commons can't say yes or no to it. The members have decided to do it. You know, certainly... I am not involved in every project that the Commons is doing now, which is a wonderful sign of success, I think. And so, you know, if somebody who was, you know, of course, Dave Collins is the obvious person, but he has a really full-time job and a family, four kids. So, you know, if we were able to support him full-time for a couple of years, it might be possible, but that's serious money. On the other hand, writing grants and putting a couple $100,000 in can happen. It depends on the skill of the grant writer, if I was the grant writer, and the people who want it on the other side. So, I mean, that could happen. I mean, software development efforts and code base efforts generally cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They generally do. Or they cost the dedication of very good people on an open source team who are professionals, who are not futzing around and have good leadership. So if good leadership existed, I could serve as a cheerleader, but I could not serve as the technical lead on the Traveler project. I could help write a grant to get the money, and I could make sure that the Commons administered the grant properly and did the performance payments and whatnot. So I can do all that stuff, but I can't do the technical lead and the design lead of a new traveler. You know, I can be there to give advice on what I think the priorities would be, because I've seen software projects succeed and fail frequently on trying to do too much and not staging their goals properly. So truthfully, if there was a group within the extended traveler community that felt that they had the skills and they had the time and the commitment, and maybe even connections to possible grant sources, you know, we could initiate this project. We would have to go to Dave Collins. We'd have to say, Dave, we have formed a group, and it is going to go after grants, and it is going to make a cross-platform version. We want to know if you would be involved as an architect or whatever. If we got grants, would you be involved? Could you be a paid consultant? Because you are the actual current lead of, you are the technical lead of the Traveler code base, you know, by default. Even though Digital Space owns that copy, the work that he's done since that point, you know, it's kind of his baby, and he has to be 100% behind us taking the work that he's done since that time and extending it and how you want to participate. But I'd be very happy to say this is, you know, I'm involved, I'll sign up, and then it becomes a formal project when any member decides to make it so. So, you know, perhaps yourself, Steve Turner, Harold, Harold already expressed an interest in this, and anybody from the extended traveler communities. You don't have to be a sort of a signed, sealed, card-carrying member of the Commons in order to be involved in a project. You know, that's generally how you would become a member of the Commons, is be involved in a project for a while anyway. So if you wanted to form that kernel to drive Traveler to the new thing, and then we all, as a group, we compose the proposal, and we talk to Dave Collins, and he'd probably zip us a release of the code and say, on condition that blah, blah, some kind of condition that he'd be involved if we managed to get funding, and that he'll help us, but he has limited time. I expect that's what he would, what he'd come back with. And then it started, and it could be, that's official. So long answer to short question.
I hope you don't mind me hitting on that issue so many times. I know you often hear questions about, you know, the future of Traveler and the possibilities, you know, that that we might throw at it. But it is something that's pretty important to us, and, you know, I hope you could at least forgive our passion in it.
Well, I think the key thing that I hope I'm communicating is you have total permission to go ahead and initiate this. There is nothing, you don't need my, you know, I would hope that you would assume that you would need my participation, but you don't need my approval. And that's the way the Commons is. And you just have to, you have to actually, in a sense, make your case by putting together the package and saying, here's what I think we can do. And then people who have the wisdom around software project can say, well, that looks pretty viable. Because there is a drag on resources with any new project, but you have complete permission to go ahead and assemble that. And of course, Steve Turner is really good key here, because he has a very good relationship with Dave Collins. You know, I have a good relationship with Dave Collins, but it's a little bit trickier for me, because I'm the head of a company. I'm a member of the Commons, but I'm a head of a company. And for him to respond to my request is kind of different than he's responding to the request of the user base. If you can, hopefully you can see that. You know, because do I have the power to hire him? It's competitive with, is it competitive with Adobe, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we have a great relationship. I basically recommended him for the position that he now holds at Adobe, to Michael Kaplan, and he was then hired. So Well, there's a connection there. But it really comes down to a group getting together, working as a team, and putting together a proposal and a package and saying, we're going to attempt grants, we're going to attempt, here's the goals for the platform, we're going to attempt to do grants, we're going to involve institutions, we're going to do a community source license. I would recommend, rather than open source, at the beginning, like a Mozilla type arrangement, and just saying it's official, we're putting up a page, it's called Open Traveler or Traveler 2 or whatever you want to call it. If you want a mailing list at the Commons, you can request that. If you want web space, you request that. All kinds of services. If you want a code, source code, system, a source safe system, you could request that, and then it would be provided, and all those facilities would be provided.
Well, I certainly have some resources that I could throw at it. I can find some university support and things like that, but any project to enable this is going to have to involve Dave Collins and or a linkable, compilable version of the source. And until we have that, you know, we're basically just blowing smoke. Once I have that, that will immediately set things in motion. You know, after that, I've already talked to people who are interested and I think committed to making a future version of Traveler happen, and then down the road, you know, as priority would allow, a cross-platform compatible version. But as I said, the main stopping point has always been Dave Collins and the compilable version of the source. And at least if we had that and no more support from him, we would at least have a basis from which we could move forward. And so that's why I'm, you know, that's why I stress that so much.
I think the best channel to do this and the most appropriate channel I would recommend is to get the list of people together who are going to be part of this, is to, of course, get Steve DePaula on board and have someone make the connection. And I would suggest Steve DePaula's excellent. Yeah, Steve calls up Dave Collins and says, look, we're serious. I've got my group at the university. We've got some goals. We have all these people. We have the people in the community. We are going to write grants, and we're going to create a future for Traveler, and I would really very much invite you to be part of this thing and to define what role you would like. But we really respectfully request, if you can help us get started, if you could gift the project the work you've done in the last, you know, this year to get going and just see what happens. And generally, I think, you know, with the relationship those guys had, as you heard yesterday, I think it'll happen. But we have to put something together that looks real. And, you know, coming out of this event, I really had hoped that would happen. I think it's going to happen. You know, come January, you're gonna see the exciting event of this thing happening. And, you know, Dave being as busy as he is and whatever, you know, Steve Turner can call him up, you know, he's talked to Steve Turner, I can contact him, and we can say, look, you know, we're going to keep the code and community source and not going to be released anyway, and you're part of it, and please zip it up and send it, because people are waiting to start studying it. And they'll go, all right, you know, come on, don't have time, everything's crazy at Adobe, there's so much work to do, and it'll just happen. We must respect the fact that this has been Dave Collins' baby for a decade. And, you know, when I did that effort to try to save the platform, I always realized that this man has spent 10 years of his life, you know, off and on inside this platform. So there's an emotional connection, and maybe he's considering that there's potentially a business, that if a business did arise around this, that he's fully entitled to participate in that. So we really have to draw that package together, and then our spokesman really should be Steve DePaula. You know, who better?
I agree. I think one of the decisions we should make on the front end is that, you know, while I think the ASELP is an excellent codec,
that it would incur some sort of liability. You know, we would have to pay for the privilege. The server operators would have to be, you know, pay for license, you know, for however many channels, something like that. And so I think the Speaks codec seems a lot more useful to us in that regard, and it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't cut everybody involved. So one of the things, and indeed Dave Collins suggested this himself, and I think we should hire for an alternative codec to one that would, keep costing us money.
Here's the situation with VoiceAge. In the summer, in order to extend our agreement, which concludes in June of 2005, in order to extend the agreement, we would have to buy another 600 or 700 channels, and we were not able to sell that many VoiceAge Talkspace servers. And things like Skype now have really taken the market. So we told them basically we were exiting that business. We're not trying to sell multi-user servers. And we would like an early termination of the agreement. Now, what that leaves us with, and they granted that, there's still a little bit of back and forth about it. But what that leaves us with is about 600 channels of outright purchased channels. And the current version, the new version that Dave was able to link has the ALSEP codec in it. And it is our understanding that we have the right to 600 more channels of ALSEP codec in any new server that we make. Now, of course, I think Dave's talking about build of the client, not the build of the server. But that's okay, too, because the ALSEP codec is licensed on the client, as it was with Talkspace. So we can go ahead, and if we continue development on the ALSEP VoiceAge version of that Dave has delivered, that's fine. We can probably put that right into test and develop that. But I would suggest, as Oz has suggested and as Dave Collins has suggested, we have to make a priority to move to the Speaks or another open source codec so we don't have any issues at all. And this is what Digital Space has done on the 3D side. We've moved to the Ogre 3D engine on the open source. So we don't have any issues of licensing issues and restrictions. So I think the interim new client would be to get it up to the level of where we are now with the logo art and the right URLs and stuff and paths in it, and build it, and then start to say, okay, we have now a new buildable client, but it uses ALSEP, but we have a limited number of channels that support a few of the servers. I didn't want to experiment with it, but then we start off on the Speaks integration before we really went hugely public with an all-new traveler. So anyway, that's just reiterating what Oz has said and what Dave Collins has said.
Star has told me that Eagle Wolf is here and would like me to announce the next event.
And I think we probably should wrap it up. Are there any other closing thoughts for the session? I thank you very much for your patience for these almost 2 hours. And your
attention. I have another question.
Go ahead, Rillo.
Well, you were on the other side of the globe when you heard about a mud in Australia, in Arizona. That was interesting enough for you to go seek out and see what was going on there. And now you have a community of travelers, people who are willing to keep a part of a lot of music and can see themselves in this same environment doing exactly what they're now 5 to 10 years from now. What kind of examples do you think we're setting for other virtual communities that might be around now or might be around in the future? How do you see this as a projected model of what you see the future to be in virtual?
And we'd be happy to have anybody.
I think Star was talking over Brillo, and I think maybe they're not hearing each other. I believe Star was talking about the next event, and Brillo was asking about what do you think Traveler would represent to future virtual communities. I think that the very success of the model, the immersion success and the social success of the traveler model, has to emerge somewhere else. Somebody's going to emulate it. And there was no patents filed on any of this technology. So there may be patents that have been filed with no reference to this prior art. The traveler may be important for one huge thing, and that somebody who's trying to restrict the communication modalities through patent challenges may be unable to do that because of the existence of traveler. This happened with Maze War, a game from the early 70s. It was a multi-user 3D game that has kept the idea of multi-user 3D in the public domain because of its prior art. So I think that, and well, I'm sort of watching for that, if that actually appears. Because undoubtedly there have been a dozen patents filed on the idea of real-time voice phoneme extraction driving a morphing face. But, you know, perhaps they were filed after 1994-95. I don't know why OnLive or EnterTV did not file any patents, but they didn't. So anyway, that's a short answer to Virilo's question. So legal impact, I think, will be there. Now the next event, I think, is 4 o'clock. So I think we just got a broadcast from Maxi here. Okay, everybody check the schedule, and we should probably start joining the next event. There may be space in there without going to overflow, but I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Ozgate and Oz and Lady J and Maxi and Dominic and everybody who I haven't thanked for the chance to speak today.
I just want to mention also Bruce did talk about Steve Turner on the Commons, and he's going to be speaking later. I don't know if you guys got to say this because I lost audio for some part of it, but he will be speaking later on, back here on Ozgate around 7 p.m. Pacific time.
Also, I'd like to remind everybody that there is a portal from here to both of the other Travatars 2004 spaces. The next event will be at Travelers Network, and there is a portal from here to there, so you won't have to fumble around with your web pages to find it.
Thanks a lot for the talk, Bruce, and thanks, Dawes, for hosting the talk.
Well, my pleasure, brother. Okay, see you guys at the next stop.
See y'all there.